Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a topic that's just fundamental for anyone heading into healthcare, especially for you nursing students listening in.
Absolutely.
We're diving into bipolar disorder and the medications used to manage it. This isn't just about facts for an exam.
Yeah, at all.
This knowledge is really your foundation for safe, effective practice in psych nursing. We're talking patient safety, comprehensive care.
Exactly. It's about understanding the nuances, right?
Yeah. So our plan is, first, get a solid handle on what bipolar disorder actually is, the different types. Then we'll get into the nitty-gritty of the main mood stabilizers, lithium, carbamazepine, valproic acid. We'll break down how they work, what you need to watch for, and how to talk to patients about them.
And it's so important. Treating bipolar disorder, it's complex, medically speaking, but it also needs real sensitivity. This deep dive, it's really set up to give you, our future nurses, that core understanding. Not just to spot symptoms, but to monitor closely, and maybe most importantly, to educate your patients effectively. Knowing how to navigate these powerful meds safely, that's a cornerstone of psychiatric nursing. It really underpins patient well-being.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Before we jump into the meds themselves, we really need a solid grasp of bipolar disorder. It's not just one thing, is it?
No, definitely not. It's more of a spectrum. And understanding those differences is like step one for any nurse. If you don't get the distinctions, you could misread things, treatment might not align. It's fundamental.
So what are the main categories we need to know?
Okay, so we generally talk about three primary types. First, there's bipolar I disorder. This is often what people think of. It's defined by having at least one full manic episode.
And a full manic episode is intense, right?
Yeah.
Not just feeling good.
Oh, way beyond feeling good. It's a distinct period, usually a week or more, of abnormally elevated, expansive, or even irritable mood. Plus, the surge in energy, goal-directed activity, but it's often scattered, impulsive.
Like needing very little sleep, but feeling wired.
Exactly. Maybe sleeping only 2-3 hours, but feeling totally energetic. Reckless spending, grand ideas, way out of touch with reality, talking super fast, jumping from topic to topic.
Irritability, too.
Yeah. Intense irritability can be a big part of it. Any little thing can set them off. It often causes serious problems in their job, relationships. Hospitalization is pretty common, honestly, sometimes just for safety because judgment is so impaired. These manic episodes can come before or after hypomanic or depressive episodes, but that full mania is the key for bipolar one.
Okay. Got it. Bipolar I, full mania. What's next?
Then you have bipolar II disorder. The defining thing here is a pattern of major depressive episodes and at least one hypomanic episode, but critically without ever having a full manic episode.
So hypomania, less severe mania.
Right. The mood's still up or irritable, more energy, but it doesn't cause that major impairment in functioning. They usually don't need hospitalization for the hypomania itself. Sometimes people in a hypomanic state can actually feel pretty good, productive, creative. They might not even see it as a problem.
But the two doesn't mean it's less serious overall, right?
Not at all. That's a crucial point. The depressive episodes in bipolar II can be just as severe, just as debilitating as in major depressive disorder. Really deep, long-lasting lows. Often, it's the depression that brings the person in for help.
And the hypomania might get missed.
Frequently, it might be seen as just a good mood spell or a time they got a lot done. So bipolar II is often misdiagnosed initially as just depression, but that cycling between depression and hypomania still significantly disrupts life.
Makes sense. Okay, so bipolar mania, bipolar II, hypomania plus depression. What's the third one?
The third one is cyclothymia. Think of this as a more chronic but milder form. It involves numerous periods of hypomanic symptoms and depressive symptoms over at least 2 years, 1 year for kids and teens.
But the symptoms don't quite hit the full criteria for a hypomanic or major depressive episode.
Exactly. It's like this constant lower level fluctuation. The mood rarely settles into a stable, normal range or euthymia. Mm-hmm. It's not the extreme highs and lows of I or II, but this persistent up and down can be really wearing, affecting relationships, work, just a feeling of being on an emotional roller coaster that doesn't stop.
And it's important to catch because
it can sometimes progress to bipolar one or two. So recognizing it allows for earlier intervention, potentially preventing more severe episodes down the line.
Okay, so knowing these differences, bipolar one through cyclothymia, it's clearly not just academic for a nurse. Mm-hmm. How does this translate directly into care planning? Why is it so crucial when we're looking at a patient?
It's totally foundational. It guides everything. Your assessment, your treatment plan. For instance, someone with bipolar 1 having had that full mania might need more immediate, robust mood stabilization. Maybe a stronger focus on anti-manic meds right off the bat.
Compared to bipolar 2, where maybe the focus is more on the depression.
Often, yes. Managing those debilitating depressive episodes and preventing future hypomania becomes key. Knowing the diagnosis helps you anticipate the patient's specific challenges. Are they dealing with intense mood swings, deep depression, chronic instability? It tells you what symptoms to monitor closely, what education they need, which nursing interventions will be most effective. It lets you tailor the whole approach.
And it influences medication choices too, presumably.
Absolutely. And while we're focusing today on lithium, carbamazepine, and valproic acid, the sort of classic mood stabilizers, it's really important to know the toolkit is actually broader.
Right. You mentioned others briefly.
Yeah. Just for context, you've got second generation antipsychotics that pull double duty as mood stabilizers. Things like quetiapine, you know, Seroquel, often good for anxiety, sleep issues too. Olanzapine, Zyprexa, potent for mania. Aripiprazole, Abilify, Risperidone, Risperdal, Ziprasidone, Geodone. They all have roles.
And that combination one?
Oh, Sanfloxetine, Symbiax, specifically for bipolar depression. And then there's Lamotrigine, Lamictal, and anticonvulsant, we will discuss more, particularly known for preventing depressive episodes.
Okay, so a wider range of options depending on the specific patient picture.
Exactly. It often involves careful selection, sometimes combinations tailored to that individual, but understanding these core three gives you a really strong base.
All right, let's dive into that base then, starting with the big one. Lithium carbonate. Often the first-line choice, right? A real classic. It's just a salt, but what it does in the brain is pretty amazing.
It really is. Lithium carbonate brand names Escalith. Lithobid, it's a cornerstone. And fascinating, partly because we still don't fully understand exactly how it works. Isn't that something? After all these years?
Seriously. So what do we know?
Well, we know it influences a lot of things. It seems to affect how several key neurotransmitters are made, released, and taken back up. Acetylcholine, dopamine, GABA, norepinephrine. It might stabilize the receptors they bind to, sort of calming down the signaling noise.
Okay, so it's balancing things out.
In a way, yeah. And here's something really interesting, especially for patient education. Emerging research suggests lithium might actually be neuroprotective.
Neuroprotective, like it protects brain cells.
Potentially, yes. Stimulating neuronal growth, maybe increasing gray matter volume in mood centers, protecting cells from damage. It suggests it's not just managing symptoms day to day.
Wow, that's a powerful point for adherence. It's not just a temporary fix. It might be helping preserve brain health long term.
Exactly. It reframes it. It's an investment in their brain's future health, potentially. A really important concept for nurses to convey.
So, therapeutically, its main job is?
Primarily treating and preventing those acute manic and hypomanic episodes. And it's super important for maintenance therapy, reducing the frequency and severity of future episodes, both manic and depressive. Trying to keep things level long term.
Okay, now for the really critical nursing part, that narrow therapeutic range. You hear this constantly with lithium.
And for very good reason. This is maybe the most important thing for a nurse to grasp. The therapeutic range is tiny. Roughly 0.5 to 1.2 MEQL, maybe 0.6 to 1.2, depending on the lab.
That doesn't leave much wiggle room.
None at all. Think about it, a tiny shift in dose, or if the patient gets dehydrated, eats less salt, gets sick. Anything that affects fluid or electrolyte balance can push them from being therapeutic right into being toxic very quickly.
So constant vigilance is key.
Paramount. Your assessment, your monitoring, your education, it all revolves around managing this delicate balance. You are the safety note.
How is it usually given? And what about dosing?
It's taken orally, usually best with food or milk or right after eating to minimize stomach upset, which is pretty common. The dose, highly individual. It's constantly adjusted based on blood levels, symptom control, and side effects.
And older adults or people with kidney issues?
Lower doses are almost always needed. Age slows things down, and kidney function is absolutely critical because lithium isn't broken down by the body. It's almost entirely cleared by the kidneys. So impaired kidneys mean the drug builds up.
And it's usually long-term therapy.
Yes, because relapse rates are really high if it's stopped, which of course brings up the challenge of compliance. And before starting, you always check electrolytes, especially sodium and kidney function. That's baseline.
Okay, let's talk side effects. What are the common expected things patients might experience that we monitor but aren't necessarily alarms.
Right, the expected stuff. You'll almost always see polyuria peeing a lot, and consequently increased thirst. That's just lithium affecting how the kidneys handle water.
Makes sense. What else?
A fine hand tremor, like a subtle quiver. This is really important to distinguish from the coarse tremor of toxicity. Mild GI upset, maybe some weight gain, fatigue. Those are common too.
And the thyroid issue.
Yes, hypothyroidism is a definite risk. Lithium can interfere with the thyroid gland, so regular thyroid function tests are crucial. You might also see slightly elevated white blood cell counts, leukocytosis, and minor electrolyte shifts. These are things we watch, manage, educate about.
Okay, now the red flags. What are the signs of toxicity when levels creep above 1.5 milliqEQL? This is the emergency scenario.
Absolutely. This needs immediate action. The coarse hand tremors are a big one, much shakier, more irregular than the fine tremor. Increasing confusion, disorientation, maybe even progressing to delirium.
What else?
Hypotension, low blood pressure, risk of seizures in severe cases, tinnitus, that ringing in the ears. The GI symptoms get much worse, significant persistent diarrhea and vomiting. This is dangerous because it worsens dehydration and electrolyte loss, making toxicity even worse.
A vicious cycle.
Exactly. Profound drowsiness, lethargy, significant muscle weakness, and that unsteady walk like ataxia. High fall risk. Seeing these signs, that's an immediate call to the provider. Hold the dose. Get a stat level.
That distinction, fine tremor versus coarse tremor, mild GI upset versus severe vomiting diarrhea, really highlights the nurse's assessment skills.
It's critical observation and interpretation. Absolutely.
So beyond observing for toxicity, what's the routine monitoring checklist for lithium?
Okay, your non-negotiable checklist. Number one, regular serum lithium levels. Baseline, frequently during dose changes, then maybe monthly or every few months once stable. That's your direct window into that narrow range.
Number two.
Kidney function. Creatinine and BUN. Remember, it's almost entirely kidney excreted. You have to know the kidneys are working well both before starting and ongoing. Nephrotoxicity is a long-term risk.
And number three, you emphasized sodium.
Yes, monitor sodium levels and understand that critical inverse relationship. Low sodium, higher lithium retention, increased toxicity risk. The kidneys try to hold on to sodium, and they grab lithium along with it if sodium is scarce.
So things like low-salt diets, excessive sweating, vomiting, diarrhea, diuretics, all raise the risk.
Precisely. They all deplete sodium and or fluid, telling the kidneys to hold on to lithium more tightly. That's why your baseline assessment before starting needs renal, cardiac, thyroid function, and electrolytes, especially sodium.
Okay, monitoring leads right into patient education. How do we empower patients to manage this safely?
This is where nursing shines. You have to teach them to maintain adequate and consistent sodium and fluid intake, usually 8-12 glasses of water daily. Consistency is key.
And avoiding big fluid salt losses.
Right. Avoid excessive sweating if possible, or replenish fluids and electrolytes carefully if they do. And absolutely report any illness with vomiting or diarrhea immediately to their provider. That's a high-risk situation.
What about diet?
Do not suddenly change dietary salt intake. Drastically cutting salt can make lithium levels rise. They need consistency. And NO diuretics or NSAIDs, not even over-the-counter ibuprofen or naproxen without checking with their provider first. Diuretics mess with sodium fluid balance. NSAIDs can hurt kidneys and raise lithium levels.
Huge points. Any other cautions?
Be extra careful with patients who already have kidney issues, dehydration, low salt diets, or poor cardiac output. And really talk about compliance. Explain why staying on it is important, even when they feel better, and help them manage side effects.
And specific contraindications or major interactions?
Definitely contraindicated in severe renal disease. Diuretics and NSAIDs are generally out, as we said. ACE inhibitors, sometimes SSRIs. Alcohol can increase risk too. And tell surgeons and anesthesiologists, if a patient is on lithium, it can prolong effects of anesthesia. It's a lot, but crucial for safety.
Wow. Okay, lithium requires intense nursing focus. But what if it's not the right fit? You mentioned anticonvulsants stepping in as mood stabilizers too.
Exactly. Not everyone responds to lithium, or they might have kidney problems or other issues making it unsuitable. So thankfully, we have other excellent options, primarily certain anticonvulsants that also stabilize mood. They have different ways of working, different side effects, different monitoring. Equally important to know inside out.
Let's start with carbamazepine or Tegretol. How does that one work?
Carbamazepine seems to work by decreasing nerve firing in the brain, likely by affecting sodium channels. Think of it like slowing down the overly rapid electrical activity you see in mania.
And its uses.
It's used for seizures, definitely, and also trigeminal neuralgia pain. But it's a really important player in bipolar disorder too, especially for patients with rapid cycling, lots of mood episodes per year, or mixed features where mania and depression happen at the same time. Sometimes these folks don't respond as well to lithium.
Okay, the critical nursing alert for carbamazepine. The big thing to watch for.
Blood dyscrasias. This is the major one. It means problems with blood cell production. It can cause anemia, low red blood cells, leading to fatigue, weakness, leukopenia, low white blood cells, especially neutrophils, making patients incredibly vulnerable to infections. A simple cold could become serious.
So watching for fever, sore throat.
Exactly. And thrombocytopenia, low platelets. This means problems with blood clotting, easy bruising, little red spots called petechiae, nosebleeds, bleeding gums.
So because of these risks, monitoring is key.
Absolutely non-negotiable. Regular complete blood counts, CBCs, are essential. Baseline, then often weekly for a while, then monthly, then maybe every few months long term. You're looking for any drop in those cell counts, and patient education is vital. Report fever, sore throat, fatigue, unusual bruising or bleeding immediately.
Are there other significant side effects besides the blood issues?
Yes. Neurological ones like drowsiness, dizziness, unsteadiness, blurred vision are common, especially at first, but often improve. The other really big one is the risk of serious skin reactions. Stevens-Johnson syndrome, SJS, or toxic epidermal necrolysis, TAN.
Those sound serious.
They are. Rare, but potentially life-threatening. It's a severe blistering rash. The risk is higher in people of Asian descent due to a specific gene marker, HLA-B502, so genetic testing might be done first in those populations. But any patient developing a rash on carbamazepine needs immediate medical evaluation.
How is it usually given? Anything tricky there?
Usually started low and titrated up slowly to minimize side effects. And it's known as an auto-inducer. It speeds up its own metabolism over time, so the dose might need adjusting. This also means it interacts with a lot of other drugs, often making them less effective, like oral contraceptives, warfarin, certain antifungals, even some antipsychotics. Need really good medication reconciliation.
Okay, that's carbamazepine. Watch the blood counts, watch the skin. Titrate slowly, lots of interactions.
Got it.
Let's move to valproic acid, or Depakote. Different mechanism.
Yes, different mechanism. Valproic acid, or Depakote, primarily works by increasing levels of GABA in the brain. GABA is the main inhibitory neurotransmitter the brain breaks. So more GABA means less neuronal excitability, which helps calm mania and stabilize mood.
And its uses. Also seizures in bipolar.
Correct. Very effective for seizures and a major player in bipolar disorder, particularly for acute mania, mixed episodes, and rapid cycling. Often considered a first-line choice for these situations.
All right. Critical nursing alerts for valproic acid. What are the big dangers here?
Three main ones to drill into your memory. Hepatotoxicity, liver damage, pancreatitis, inflammation of the pancreas, and thrombocytopenia, low platelets.
Liver damage. How would we see that?
Signs like jaundice, yellow skin, or eyes, dark urine, pale stools, feeling really unwell, maybe pain in the upper right abdomen. It's serious. So you must monitor liver function tests, LFTs, AST, ALT at baseline, and frequently, especially early in treatment, and educate patients on those signs.
And pancreatitis.
That's inflammation of the pancreas. Usually presents as severe abdominal pain, often radiating to the back, plus nausea, vomiting, fever. This is an emergency, too. You'd monitor for these symptoms, anticipate labs like amylase and lipase.
And thrombocytopenia again, like with carbamazepine.
Yes, low platelets, so increased risk of bruising and bleeding. Need to monitor platelet counts. These three, liver, pancreas, platelets, are your top safety concerns with valproic acid.
What about other common side effects?
GI upset is common, nausea, vomiting, indigestion. Sedation can happen. Weight gain can be significant and really impact adherence. Tremors can occur too.
Anything specific for female patients?
Yes, very important. There's a risk of developing polycystic ovary syndrome, PCOS. And if taken during pregnancy, there's a significantly increased risk of neural tube defects like spina bifida in the baby. This means very careful discussions about contraception and pregnancy planning are essential, often with high-dose folic acid supplementation if pregnancy is a possibility.
So contraindications would include liver disease.
Definitely contraindicated in significant liver disease. Also interacts with various drugs, often by inhibiting the metabolism, which means it can increase levels of drugs like phenobarbital, phenytoin, warfarin. Again, careful med reconciliation. Education needs to cover those serious warnings. Liver, pancreas, bleeding, plus the pregnancy risks.
The liver and pancreas risks really stand out. Okay, we also mentioned lamotrigine, Lanigdol. You said it's particularly good for bipolar depression. Let's flesh that one out more.
Yes, absolutely. Lamotrigine, or Lamictal, is a really important mood stabilizer, but its profile is quite different. It seems to work by affecting sodium channels too, but also maybe glutamate, an excitatory neurotransmitter. Its real strength, its unique niche, is in preventing and treating the depressive episodes of bipolar disorder.
So, less for mania, more for the lows.
Generally, yes. It's not considered very effective for stopping acute mania, but it's excellent for maintenance therapy to prevent future depressive relapses, or sometimes used to treat an existing depression. This makes it invaluable, especially for bipolar 2 or patients whose main struggle is depression.
Okay, the critical number one absolute nursing alert for lamotrigine.
Stevens-Johnson syndrome, SJS, or toxic epidermal necrolysis, TEN, that serious, potentially fatal skin rash.
Same as carbamazepine, but is the risk profile different?
The risk is highest with lamotrigine during the first 2 or 8 weeks of treatment, especially if the dose is started too high or increased too quickly. This is why the mantra for lamotrigine is start low, go slow. Extremely slow dose titration over weeks or even months is absolutely crucial to minimize this risk.
So the titration schedule is paramount.
Non-negotiable. That slow, gradual increase is the key safety measure. Starting over, if doses are missed, can also increase risk, so consistency matters too.
Other common side effects. Do we need blood monitoring like the others?
Common side effects are usually milder dizziness, unsteadiness, blurred or double vision, nausea, headache, sleepiness, usually transient. And no, routine blood monitoring like LFTs or CBCs isn't typically required, which is different. But that puts even more pressure on you, the nurse, to do meticulous skin assessment.
So interactions. You mentioned valproic acid affects it.
Yes, big interaction there. Valproic acid increases lamotrigine levels, so if they're used together, you have to start lamotrigine at an even lower dose and titrate even more slowly. Conversely, carbamazepine can decrease lamotrigine levels, possibly requiring a higher lamotrigine dose.
And patient education focuses squarely on.
Report any rash, no matter how small it seems, immediately, and understand and stick to that slow titration schedule. Don't try to speed it up. For women, also discuss potential interaction with oral contraceptives, might make them less effective, and the very small potential risk regarding oral clefts in pregnancy, though that's debated. So again, family planning.
Wow, okay. That's a huge amount of detail on each drug. Lithium, carbamazepine, valproic acid, lamotrigine, each with its own profile. Now, let's try to pull it all together. As nurses, we have to integrate this, right? Apply it.
Exactly. It's not just lists. It's connecting the dots for real patient care.
Yeah.
Let's quickly compare the key nursing differences again.
Monitoring.
Lithium, serum levels, kidneys, creatinine and BUN, thyroid, sodium, frequent labs, carbamazepine, CBC for blood dyscrasias, regular labs, valproic acid, LFTs for liver, maybe amylocellulase for pancreas, platelets, regular labs, lamotrigine, primarily clinical observation skin checks, no routine labs for toxicity.
B-side effect alarms.
Lithium, kidney damage, toxicity, coarse tremor, confusion, thyroid, carbamazepine, blood issues, infection bleeding risk, serious rash, SJS in. Valproic acid, liver damage, pancreatitis, low platelets, lamotrigine, that critical SJS in rash risk.
Patient education priorities match these risks.
Perfectly. Lithium, fluid salt consistency, report illness, avoid NSAI diuretics, carbamazepine, report fever, sore throat, bruising, any rash, valproic acid, report signs of liver pancreas issues, bleeding, pregnancy planning, lamotrigine, report any rash immediately, stick to slow titration.
Okay, let's make it real. Imagine a patient, Mrs. Vance, newly diagnosed bipolar EI, starting lithium. Walk us through the nursing care plan highlights.
Right. Assessment. Get those baseline labs. Kidney, thyroid, electrolytes, ECG maybe. Then ongoing assessment. Mental status, mood, sleep, energy, but also specifically asking about thirst, urination, tremors. Watching closely for that shift from fine to coarse tremor, any confusion. Asking about diet, hydration, other meds.
Administration. Give with food milk. Emphasize consistent timing. Explain why she can't just stop or change the dose.
Monitoring. Ensure she gets her blood drawn regularly for levels, kidney function. Explain the results to her in simple terms. Watch that sodium.
Education. This is huge. Explain the narrow therapeutic range simply. Go over signs of toxicity. Clearly use teach back. Explain the fluid salt balance, why it matters for her kidneys and the medicine.
Yeah.
List the drugs to avoid, NSAIDs, diuretics, stress reporting, vomiting, diarrhea. Maybe involve family if she agrees.
Interventions for toxicity, if you suspect it. Immediate action. Notify provider, hold dose, get stat level, anticipate supportive care like IV fluids, maybe ECG, maybe even dialysis prep in severe cases. Safety first.
Let's hit that sodium-lithium link one more time. Why is consistent salt intake, SO, vital? Seems counterintuitive sometimes.
It really does, but it's pure kidney physiology. Lithium is a salt. The kidneys reabsorb sodium to maintain balance. If sodium intake drops significantly, the kidneys try harder to hold on to whatever sodium or sodium-like lithium is there.
So they grab more lithium.
Exactly. They retain more lithium because they're trying to conserve sodium. Levels go up, toxicity risk skyrockets. It's not about eating lots of salt. It's about keeping intake consistent day to day, along with good hydration, so the kidneys handle lithium predictably.
Got it. Consistency is the key word there.
Precisely. And that leads to the final big challenge across all these meds, compliance or adherence.
Yeah, that's always tough with chronic illness, especially mental health.
It really is. People feel better, think they don't need it. Side effects are burdensome. It's complex. But this is where nursing makes such a difference. Empathetic education, explaining the why, helping manage side effects, building trust, providing practical tools like reminders.
It's about partnership, not just giving pills.
Absolutely. You're empowering them, advocating for them, helping them stay stable long term. That's huge.
This has been incredibly thorough. So for our nursing students listening, the takeaway is...
And a big responsibility, right?
It is. A profound responsibility, managing these powerful medications, but also an incredible opportunity to genuinely change lives. Your knowledge, your vigilance, your compassion, they're critical.
It's more than just the science.
So much more. Beyond the mechanisms and the lab values, remember the person. You're caring for individuals facing immense challenges. Your ability to monitor, educate, advocate, using this knowledge. That's the difference between success and harm. Think about how you'll partner with them, ensure their safety, help them find stability and quality of life. Your expertise is truly their lifeline. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We really hope this gives you, our future nurses, a solid practical foundation for caring for patients with bipolar disorder. Keep learning, keep asking questions. Your work makes all the difference. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.